The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. It's the end of Europe. The end of the European leagues, at least. Atleti win La Liga, Suarez the star, Simeone's cute side and Trippier running up and down. A great achievement. Is this the start of something? How will Barca and Real react? No Madridistas in the Spain squad. What does that mean? In Italy, Juve squeeze into the Champions League as Napoli fluff their lines. Good enough for Pirlo? Good enough for Ronaldo? There's an excellent Liga ready meal pre-prepared by Philippe Auclair. Well, we'll discuss Lewandowski's extraordinary goal-scoring record. Plus your questions, of course. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Hi, Max.
Nicky Bandini, well, hello.
Morning.
And hello, Sid Lowe.
Hello, Max.
Right, should we start in Spain, Sid? Why not? Atleti won the league. I presume you know this. You seem to have written quite a lot of articles about that and everything else in the last sort of 4 days. Two second-half goals. I mean, it wasn't straightforward, that win, was it? Correa's goal was beautiful, but Suarez the story? Feels like the story.
Yeah, Suarez is very definitely the story of the season, because obviously not just the fact that he scores 21 goals for the league champions, not just the fact that he scores the goal that finally wins in the league, but that he'd done it as well the previous game. So two games in a row, they had to come from a goal down and 1-2-1. Both times Suarez gets the winner. His 21 goals have directly given them 21 points this season. So no other player has directly contributed so many points. And then, of course, he's the story because of the story itself, not just the football, because of the fact that he came from Barcelona, and then because of the reaction. And I'm sure a lot of you will have seen it, but at the end of the game, he's sobbing. I mean, he's not just crying, he is sobbing, talking to his family on FaceTime. He then goes and speaks to Spanish television and he cries then, and he talks about having felt belittled and pushed out by Barcelona. And that's, I think, a big part of the reason, not the only reason, of course, but a big part of the reason why he's been so successful this year, because I think it has fueled him in part, that desire to prove that he's still, the phrase that both him and Simeone use, still vigente, which is basically means still valid, you know, still able to play at this level. And he amply proved that. And it's a brilliant title win for Atletico Madrid. Now, I know a lot of the story throughout the year, because they took such a big lead early on, was whether or not they would hold on. And they did. And I think the fact that their big lead was whittled away shouldn't be seen in any way as a sign that they almost blew it. But because they managed to hold on, and they basically, by the end of the season, were top for 27 weeks.
And what kind of Atleti is this? I mean, because I remember when Simeone, when sort of all the old men left, or most of them did, and people decided, well, Simeone can't, he can't do a half and half. What's he going to do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, the first thing there is that this is a league title win 7 years later. There's a big gap between the two, and with an entirely new team. There are only two players still there that won the league in 2014. Those are Koke, the captain, and José María Jiménez, who I think was only 18 then, or 19, and hasn't played as much of a role this year as he would have liked because of injury and so on. And it is a shift in style. Now, we have this discussion almost every year, or it feels like it over the last 4 or 5 years, about Atletico sort of evolving into something maybe a bit more expansive, and then kind of reaching the point where they thought, actually, this sort of doesn't feel right, and kind of backing off again. And I think we've had a little bit of that this year. We've had a mixed team. So in the first half of the season, when they only lost once in the first 19 games, they were a team that very much pressed that bit higher, had more of the possession, took the game closer to the penalty area. And then there was, I think, a little bit of a moment of doubt when there was a sense of them kind of hanging on, perhaps being a bit defensive. And obviously in England, everybody saw this against Chelsea, where they were very, very defensive in the Champions League. And at that point, I think, and I include myself, we sort of looked at it and thought, is there enough true belief in taking that step forward again? And I think one of the interesting things about when, just at the point in which the season was lost and they went into the last 5 games, of which they won 4 and drew 1, which is away at Barcelona, they then seemed to have decided, okay, no, we step up and we take the game to teams again. Now, that's not to say they weren't on the edge, because they were on the edge all the way through, but they carried the game forward. And maybe the best way of explaining this is to give you a stat. Atletico Madrid's possession this year, 51%. Which is not overwhelmingly, this is a team in control of the ball, but it is the highest possession stats they've ever had with Simeone in the season. So that does tell you something about this shift, and they are playing higher up the pitch. Simeone said earlier in the season that was because of Suarez. And I think there are times that you see it. Luis Suarez has had a brilliant season, but we have also seen moments when there's a reason why you can't play on the break to him. He doesn't have that ability to run through defences anymore, to run beyond them. And so you do bring everything closer to him. And I think they've been brilliant champions, but they have been, yeah, a slight hybrid, I think, between those two things.
Barry first, Nicky, then you. That's cool.
Sid, there was an interesting quote from Simeone in your column. He said, it's not easy to win here, but you enjoy it more. What did he mean by that? Is it because they're not as establishment-y as Real and Barcelona?
Exactly that. Yeah, that he talked about the other phrase he said, which goes hand in hand with that, is he said that this shows that it's not always power that wins. You know, it's not always the biggest clubs that win. And I think a lot of people have started to feel that Simeone overplays this, because of course this is a club that spent a lot of money. This is a club that would have gone into the Super League, that spent 126 million euros, I think it was, in João Félix. But I still think it's true. If you look at the budgets, the annual budgets, they are still smaller than Real Madrid and Barcelona. And very simply, you look at the squad, their two best players this year, I mean, you can argue this, but their two best players this year are probably Luis Suárez and Marcos Llorente. One who Real Madrid didn't want and one who Barcelona didn't want. And they've won the league with them. And so, yeah, that's exactly what he was getting at, this idea that, you know, you can go and win a title, but if you win it here with everything that brings with it, with how difficult it is, it feels more meaningful. And personally, I think he's probably right. And I'm not sure that Luis Suárez would admit this publicly. In fact, he tried to avoid admitting it at the weekend. But Luis Suárez has won 5 of the last 7 league titles. Now, with the possible exception of the first at Barcelona, I'm pretty sure this one will be more meaningful to him than the others. In that sense of it's I suppose fundamentally it's about a sense of achievement, isn't it? And the sense of which you've really had to fight to make this happen.
I just I had in my head with Simeone, like a few years ago, he was talking. I felt like maybe it was just, again, the angle you come at things, the coverage that you consume more. But there was quite a lot of talk from him about, one day I'm going to manage Inter. Like, that's a job I'm going to take. And I just wonder if he's reached a point where he's just going to be at Atletico forever now. Like, is this just where you think he belongs and where he's going to? It's almost a job where, because the expectation is never that you have to win ahead of Barcelona or Real Madrid, you can have down seasons in the way that other big jobs don't allow you, perhaps. And I just wondered if you had any sense of that, what he wants from his career. Do you think he's going to be there just on and on, or do you think he's got other things he wants to do as well?
He was asked about that this weekend. And actually, he was very interesting on this, because he was asked, one of the reasons why it was interesting was the contrast. So you had Zidane and Simeone, obviously, because they played simultaneously on the final day, being asked questions at the same time. And Zidane is asked about what happens next. And he said, well, me and the club have got to talk. And of course, you think, well, you haven't got anything to talk about unless you're going, or unless you want to go, because you have a year left on your contract. Almost simultaneously, Simeone is asked what happens next year. And he said, well, that's not even a question, because I've got a contract. So he kind of answered Zidane's bit for him. He said that when they left the Calderon, and he made a big point of saying this, when we left the Calderon, I was asked if I was going to continue. And at that point, he definitely had doubts, and he had very significant doubts after the final in Milan. In fact, I think after that final in Milan, we all thought he was going, and he took, I think, a month. I can't remember how long it was, around about a month to say he was going to stay. And he made a point this weekend of saying, when you asked me that, I decided, yes, I'm going to stay because this team has a future. And he said, and today I'm delighted to be able to say I was right. And I'm really pleased that I was right. And he talked about how the club had developed, how the club had taken a step up, how the club can compete now. And of course, in a way, as you say, you can have a down season. And he also talked about the idea of a transition. He said, last year was a transition, and this year he's shown that. That's come through and proven itself. But of course, he creates expectations. He has created a situation in which it's harder for him to stay in. But he is untouchable. He has a degree of authority that's really, really significant. I think you're right. He doesn't maybe have some of the pressure that Madrid and Barcelona have, although both Madrid and Barcelona have been able to get away of not winning the league this year and talking about a transitional season in a way they've never done before. In terms of his future, the Argentinian national team at some point.
Right.
And I think we've always assumed that at some point he ends up in Italy. But right now, his position is probably stronger than it ever was. I just wonder, at what point does he say, OK, I go out of the top? I think he wants to win a Champions League before he goes. Whether or not he'll do it, of course, is another question.
I did love that, you know, the footage of him with his daughters. It's so brilliant. And for some reason, I just presumed even if he had young kids, they'd be like wizened old centre-backs.
Well, they are.
Shit-housing.
Well, they sort of are. He's got three sons from his previous marriage, who are footballers. I think it's three sons. Yeah, they're three sons who are footballers. These are his young daughters from with his current partner, who was at the game at the weekend waiting for him after the game. And she was kind of in the crowd with the rest of us, so the crowd of journalists and police and stuff. And no one knew where Simeone was. And someone had to kind of go and find, where's Cholo? His missus is here waiting for him. That's a different generation of the Simeone family.
The next Simeone for the reality
show. And by the way, one of his sons who we interviewed actually in the Guardian a couple of weeks ago it has been talking a lot about moving, and there's been lots of hints over the years that Gio Simeone would end up playing with Simeone at Atletico Madrid. But that just seems to me like a complete disaster on a family level. There's no way that can end well.
So pivoting to Atleti's rivals a little bit, first of all, with Real Madrid, this very strange sense that, I mean, no one's going on El Chingarito talking about what a scandal it is that they haven't won anything now and this sort of thing. There seems to be a weird sort of acceptance there. Maybe that the team has come to an end, that there's a generational shift that needs to happen. Is there any way Zidane can be part of that, or is he certainly going now?
Well, look, I think the decision is partly his. I think the decision is almost entirely his. I think there is an acceptance now that he goes. I think, while this might sound very harsh, that there are a lot of people who actually don't necessarily mind that he goes, so long as it's handled in the right way. And I think that at club level, there's already an assumption of this and a preparation for a post-Zidane future. I agree with you as well, by the way. I found it very, very interesting how much acceptance there's been at both Madrid and Barcelona that they don't win the league this year. Now, I suppose in both cases, because it was gone so early, and therefore there's this idea that, well, Madrid did really well to take it to the final day. And actually, they sort of did. You know, they went 18 games unbeaten at the end of the season. They pushed Atletico to the very last minute of the very last game. And that in itself is I think, an achievement. But of course, it's still Real Madrid. And this is a season which they won nothing. And that's pretty bad from Real Madrid's point of view. But then you say, well, they got to final day in the league and they got to semi-finals of the Champions League. And I'm not sure how much more you can ask for them.
And on Barcelona, it's been an odd one because obviously I remember they had their worst start in the season for 32 years, was it? And then suddenly Ronald Koeman sort of made it all work and won a ton of games. And then they seem to throw it all away again. Like the narratives have been swish, swooshing and swirling around Barcelona. And I've always kind of defended Koeman against them. There's been a lot of suggestion that he was a sort of a joke appointment and a man who should never be in charge of that club and whatever. I think he did a lot of things right this season, but I do see that he's now suggested Atletico Madrid have a better squad than they do. Certainly a more complete one, which I'm not sure I'm fully prepared to accept that.
No, I don't accept it either. I think in fairness to Koeman, the context, of course, is a manager who feels like he hasn't been defended. It's a manager who feels like he's been the focal point of criticism that maybe he doesn't deserve in the last 3 or 4 weeks, and also who has carried the team and the club for a lot of the season. Because bear in mind, for a lot of the season, they've not had a president. They've had a president, what would you call it, an interim president. He's had to be, if you like, the spokesman, not just for the team, but for the whole club, and take all of that on himself. And at that point, I think he managed it really well. But as the season's unraveled, he looks increasingly like someone who is angry and alone and not happy with how things have ended. I agree with you. I think there are some things he's done very well, but I think they have lack something when it's really mattered. And this is the weird thing about Barcelona, of course, is that they were out of it. They got themselves in a position to be in it. That game against Granada could have put them top. The first time, since week 12, that Atletico weren't top. And that's when they lost. And Laporta, the current president, said it was incomprehensible. And I think he's probably right. Also, bear in mind, Laporta's ideas probably weren't Koeman as manager anyway. And I think Koeman knows that. And that's part of the context of this. But yeah, I'm totally with you. The idea that Barcelona's squad is not good enough. Okay. Yeah, I can buy that there's some very significant flaws in the squad and some important things that need to be changed. But to try and say, well, look, I bet you have got a great squad and we haven't. You've got Dembele, Griezmann, Messi, Ter Stegen, Frankie de Jong. I mean, let's just stop there. That's five.
They play five aside. Be really good. Our league be great, wouldn't they? Oh, Messi's staying, is he?
Well, that's the assumption we're all making. And actually, the person who's been closest to telling us that was Pep Guardiola, who, when he was talking about Sergio Aguero going to Barcelona, he said, well, he's going to play with the best player in history. Now, I mean, unless they're signing Diego Ferreiro from Atletico San Luqueño, that presumably means that Messi is staying.
Maybe he meant Barry Aspas. Maybe they're bringing in.
Maybe they are buying Barry Aspas.
That's what's happening here. That's the twist. No one saw
that
coming.
Is the twist.
And you know the chaos that Gareth Bale when he said. I mean, you can't see him.
I want to know what that means. Yeah, I really do want to know what that means. Gareth Bale said it would be chaos. I mean, it would be chaos.
What would
back.
Be the most chaotic outcome for Bale that he just says he's staying? I guess that's probably the most chaotic.
Yeah, taking over from Zidane.
I mean, I think for what it's worth, look, here's a scenario for you. Real Madrid get a manager that's not Zidane. Bale comes up back with a point to prove, gets continuity, turns out to be a very good player. And here's the thing. If you look, and it doesn't just reduce to goals, but if you look at the goal contribution from Real Madrid's attacking players this year, with the exception of Benzema, it's pretty poor. And there's no doubt that Bale, had he been there, well, I say there's no doubt. That's not fair. There is a doubt. But it's pretty likely that had Bale been there, his goal contribution would have been significantly higher than any of those other attacking players.
And he might have got in the Spain squad. So they'd have had a Real Madrid player in the Spain squad.
Well, that whole debate is fairly nuts, really, because it's focused on there's no Real Madrid players in it. Okay, well, let's have a look at the Real Madrid squad and see how many Real Madrid players there could have been in it. And the answer, to be honest, is only one. And that's Nacho Fernandez. And so the focus of the debate there, I think, is very skewed, as it always is.
Sure.
Now, obviously, I realise there is a debate about Ramos, but when you look at Ramos's figures, and he's only played 4 games this year, you look at the fact that he's not fit, it's rational that he doesn't go. I'm surprised that Luis Enrique didn't wait for him a bit longer, maybe put him in an expanded squad and give him time and try and get him fit. But it's rational that he doesn't go. Who else do you put in? Maybe Marco Asensio? You're certainly not taking Odri Ozola. You're certainly not taking Isco, who is Spanish. The only other one is Nacho. And personally, yeah, I would have taken Nacho.
All right. Cheers, Sid. Let's do Italy in part two. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Rich says, is the jamminess of Juve in getting into the Champions League proof that there is no God? they beat Bologna 4-1. Morata's goals were lovely, actually. Dybala's move for the first and his first touch for his second. And Rabiot's was really nice too. But what does this mean, Nikki?
What does it mean? Well, it means, what does it Max, mean? That Juventus will be in the Champions League, as they always are. And Nobody gets to have the fun 2 days of conjecture about whether Ronaldo would play in the Europa League, which we all know he wouldn't. Whether he'll play in the Champions League for Juventus still gets to be a pretty big story. I think the message he posted on Instagram thanking everyone who's joined him on the journey certainly has a lot of people thinking, no, he really is off. And I think, honestly, you need to be pretty cautious with an end of season game against Bologna, who were not putting up much of a fight, but was one of those days when you looked at Juventus and you thought, when Pirlo first arrived and we had his thesis and everyone was excited about it. And in Italy, there was this word Pirlolandia that got made up, which is Pirlo land, basically. So it's like, oh, it's a theme park. It's going to be Pirlo land. There's going to be 5 attackers. It's going to be great. And
they would
think,
be the worst roller coaster of all time. Roller coaster. Instead of going up and down around in circles, it'd just be a really smooth ride.
But you do get it after all, everyone's just having a glass of wine and chilling. Looking a bit dopey.
I mean, it did make a lot of Juventus fans feel sick for a lot of the year, so it was doing something.
Hey.
Look, there have been moments where, despite the fact that Ronaldo has still scored more goals than anyone else in Serie A this season, another league that he's been top scorer of, they have played more interesting, dynamic football when he's not been on the pitch sometimes. And I think a lot of people looked at this last game and thought, is this another sign that actually for both parties, it might just be time to not see out that last year of the contract to move on? We'll see what happens with that. We'll see what happens with Pirlo. Actually, at the end of the last section, I was almost going to ask Sid one more question, which is all the talk about Zidane at Real Madrid. Well, there's reports in Italy that have Allegri already done as going back to Juventus. I'd heard some things about that myself in the last few weeks. But now, just in the last day or two, there's this idea that maybe Perez is going to swoop in and grab Allegri from under Juventus' noses. And could that end up being something that ends up pulling them to keep Pirlo on? I don't know if there's anything in that Real Madrid Allegri link.
Well, let me throw the other name in there. Is this a straight swap? Does Allegri go to Real Madrid and Zidane go to Juventus?
That certainly is another thought.
Yeah, and certainly Allegri is the key external candidate from Real Madrid's point of view. Raul, the current Castilla coach, is the other. There have been suggestions which I can't back up well enough to say this categorically, but that Allegri is very much the man to take over. With Zidane, the question is always, is it the French national team or Juve? And Philippe said, what was it, last week or the week before when we were on here, that he doesn't get the French national team yet, that he would have to wait for that. In which case, maybe that's where we're headed with a swap.
Where would Ronaldo go?
I've seen
States.
There's all sorts of suggestions for Ronaldo. Could be MLS. I don't think he'll want to go to MLS yet. I think he thinks he's got at least one more Champions League journey in him. There's been talk of going back to Manchester United. There's been talk of even going back to Portugal and playing for Sporting at the end of his career. I think in a great sense, he's still Ronaldo. The world is his oyster. He can choose. Of course, he has to decide how much he wants to get paid for some of those journeys. And if he's more interested in the financial side of it, I can imagine he could make a heap of money by going to the United States. But I think he's still, I don't know, I think there was still enough edge to him, despite some disappointing performances, actually, in the Champions League. And I do think that's a really striking contrast with Ronaldo in this last season. If you think the whole idea of signing Ronaldo, at least publicly, was we're trying to win the Champions League. In reality, there's also a commercial element. You're interested in your branding. You're interested in making your club big enough to lead a Super League breakaway project, maybe. But on the pitch, I would say the first two seasons, even though Juventus as a club disappointed in the Champions League, Ronaldo basically always did his bit. He always showed up in those knockout games and scored goals. This year, he's really disappointed in a lot of the big games. And I think that's the thing that's been most jarring about Ronaldo's last season at Juventus. Yes, he scored enough goals I'm trying to remember the exact number. It's like 29, I think, in Serie A this season to be the top scorer. And by a distance, it wasn't close. But when Juventus needed him in the Champions League knockout rounds against Porto, when they needed him in the big games in Serie A against Inter the first time around, against Milan at the end of the season, he didn't produce for them. And I think that's another reason why, from Juventus' point of view, even though nobody at the club has said this officially, no one is saying this out loud, but I think from a lot of people who follow the club and support the club, they're looking at it and thinking, honestly, do we still need this guy around?
The MLS thing is intriguing to me because obviously Ronaldo is a unique case, and I'm sure if he was willing to go there, then they would try to make something happen. But the fascinating thing about his position is he makes so much money at Juventus that all these sort of traditional, well, I'm old, I'm going to bugger off somewhere and make loads of money options would probably involve him taking a wage cut still. Because, I mean, the best paid player in MLS last season anyway was Higuain, who was like on $8 million a year, so just over £5 million a year, which is not even remotely close to what Juventus are paying Ronaldo. Like, and I know they'd make, obviously, he's Ronaldo and not Higuain, but the days where you go to MLS to cash in are, it's kind of generally not how it happens anymore.
Juve got in because Napoli could only draw with Hellas Verona and conceded such a sort of Sunday league, just lumper over the top. Okay, it was a nicer pass than that, I'll give you that. But still, frustrating way to not make the top four. Gattuso's gone. James says, can you shed any light on him being let go from Napoli?
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't just stick on Ronaldo, because what happened to Napoli is, it's so Napoli. It's so, so Napoli. You think it's only 3 years ago that they went to Juventus at the end of the season. I can't remember if it was April or May, but in the spring, there's about three games left in the season. They beat Juventus. They go top of the league. They are on course to end what was then, I guess, the seven-year run of Juventus titles. And it was such a moment under Maurizio Sarri. And then the very next game, they go and get thumped by Fiorentina, who are in mid-table, who have nothing to play for and who hate Juventus, by the way. So they have this sort of thing that they've done once. And now this season, they're in this position. They're ahead of Juventus. All they need to do is win their last couple of games to get into the Champions League. They go and play Fiorentina, who have Dusan Vlahovic, who's scoring heaps of goals, and they beat Fiorentina. And you think, right, finally, the monkey is off their back. Their last game is against Verona, who've taken 6 points from their last 12 games, right? So a team that is in 10th, but has long ago sort of appeared to stop giving anything to this season, certainly in the results point of view, although their manager certainly has something to say about that at the end of the game. And they play awfully and they're struggling, but Amir Amani, who's a former Verona player, scores the header that puts them in front after an hour, and you think, all right, this is it now. You've done it. You don't need to do anything else. It's Verona. They're not going to sort of fly at you. And then, as you say, concede a goal on what is literally a punt forward. It's a good ball, but it's from the edge of his own penalty area. Yeah. From the edge of his own penalty area, just straight up the pitch and undoes them. It was just such a way for Napoli to throw this away. And it's damaging. Like, it's really damaging. It's a club that has actually, yes, they haven't spent as much as Juventus. They haven't spent as much as Inter either. But after those two teams, there's no one else in Serie A who spends as much as Napoli. They spent something like 70 million euros to sign Victor Osimhen this last summer. The summer before that, they went out and they got Chucky Lozano, they got Kostas Manolas, they got Alex Meret. They spent a lot of money, and they should be a Champions League side. And to lose it in this way was just, yes, I don't know how else to put it. It is, as I said it on Twitter, it is the Italian Spursy, I think, for me.
Okay. Would, they, Nikki, have just been expecting Verona to roll over?
So this was, I mean, this was actually one of my favourite bits of the weekend, because Ivan Juric at Verona, despite this end of the season when they've been results-wise very flat, he has done a great job. The fact that Verona are 10th is quite an achievement. They're not a team that you expect to see that high up again. You want to talk about wages and all that boring stuff. And his team, so the cliche about Italian football, obviously defensive football, it's not, hasn't been true for several seasons. Serie A is actually one of the highest scoring leagues. But Juric's Verona are very much that. They're stubborn, they're resilient, they don't give up goals easily. And they've drawn with, they've taken points this season off Juventus, off Milan, off Atalanta. They have been a very stubborn team. So the reporter from Sky, Massimo Ugolini, starts saying to him after the game, you know, this was a very different performance from what we've seen from you in the last few weeks. And before he's even finished the sentence, Juric just cuts him off and goes, that's a big pile of shit right there. And he just he just will not have it. You know, tells him to start showing some respect, tells him to go and watch the games, and ends up just walking out of the press conference after 2 minutes, in which he just basically talks over him. So he is a manager, and his players clearly felt quite slighted by this narrative that they hadn't been playing well. And certainly they had a very, very good level of commitment in this game. It was kind of weird because Napoli almost looked much more sluggish. I think it's still reasonable to say that Verona hadn't played very well recently, even though Juric would disagree with me.
It almost sounds like you're scared to say it just in case he's about to join the Zoom call. I can't confirm.
It's a fun press conference. And I love him as a manager. He's done great work there. And he's one of those managers in Serie A who's, yeah.
We should mention Inter because they had a great season, Nikki. And
because they won the
Young,
league, you know, it's more detail.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Ashley Young, nearly 36. He's the oldest English player to score in Europe's top five leagues this season. Arturo Vidal, that is this stat that he has won the league for the 9th time in 10 years is, you know, from Juve to Bayern to Barca to Inter is just brilliant, isn't it? But there is this question over their ownership and then what happens to Inter now.
Yeah, it's really odd because we're going into this summer of great uncertainty in Italy. Yes, Inter just won the league. They ended the 9 years of Juventus being in charge. They got their first title since Jose Mourinho was there. And of course, Jose immediately pops up at Roma. And we don't know what happens next because Conte, he's not desperate to leave or anything, but he wants to continue building on what he's achieved. And we all know that Conte can be quite demanding of his ownerships when it comes to that sort of thing. And he'll want players. And I think I've said it on this podcast before, possibly the best thing that happened to Conte in terms of players he then managed to get more from was being told in January, no, play with the toys you've already got. But he's not going to be happy to be told that again in the summer. And there's going to be more meetings between Conte and ownership in the coming days. But so far, he has avoided giving any sort of commitment about his future. So who knows? It could yet be a very short story for Conte at Inter.
But you also look at the landscape of European football. And if he sort of wants, I want a sporting project where they'll spend a ton of money and I can sign all these old dudes and no one will complain. Where is that? Like, because no one wants to spend money this summer.
No, I think Conte is one of those slightly contradictory characters, though, because he's so furious in his competitiveness when he's in a job. And he's so sort of, this is part of the thing with him when he gives these ridiculous press conferences where he's just attacking journalists, which happened a lot in the beginning of this season and last season. I think it's because he sincerely cannot take not winning. When he's in a job, he doesn't know how to handle not winning. But I also believe that he can walk away and take a year out and not have a problem with it. From the way he talks about it, I think he genuinely is someone who would not find the idea of spending a year with his family all that hateful, in the way that you sometimes get the impression some people in football matter, might.
His family might not like that idea quite as much.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do France and Germany and the rest. Part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We have a live show, Barry, don't we? On June the 10th.
Yes, we do.
Lars, you're coming too.
I'm very excited.
Okay, it's on the laptop. It's £7. You can watch it wherever you are in the world. We've got 6 to 7 billion tickets to sell. Lars, I tried to get Barry to sell it the other day. He just exhaled in a very sad way.
Last time we did this, I had my dog eat a rather worrying bit of anatomy on camera, and that seemed to go down quite well. So let's repeat that.
Okay, that's the sort of highbrow. Yeah, that's what the Guardian were looking for.
If you want to see a giant wolf-like animal eat a trachea.
theguardian.com/guardianlive. Now I hand over to Max Rushton for a French interlude. Hello, welcome to a mini Europod within the Europod with Philippe Auclair and Barry Glendenning. You may remember them both from yesterday's podcast. Philippe, Ligue 1, Lille winning it. We did kind of expect it by the end, but it's still an amazing achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a remarkable achievement considering the circumstances in which Galtier has led his team to the title. The fact that the club has been rocked by a number of things during the season, in particular the end, or so it looks, of one regime at the head of the club, the departure of Georges Campos, which everybody knows is one of the main architects of the building of that team, change of owners, and so on, and obviously loss of players, as they do every season after performing well. And despite all of this, they've managed to get that title. It was actually a bit nervy, I must say, Max, because, last week they only drew, but thinking, okay, they know that they've got to win that last game against Angers. Angers really doesn't have anything to fight for. They're a bit like Aston Villa against Chelsea, nothing to fight for. We know what happened there. And in fact, Angers played rather well, and the score was 2-0 quite late in the game when Angers suddenly scored, and you thought, uh-oh, could it happen? So it was a bit nervy, but they got there in the end in their, what I would say, almost traditional manner, as in they're not a team that's going to make you jump out of your seat, marveling at the silkiness of the play. They will impress you by their togetherness, their organization, their defensive solidity, some individuals who's obviously will obviously catch your eye. Of course, the two up front who scored again, Yilmaz and Jonathan David. I think that's something like 31 goals between them this season. And this strange thing, they're a functional team, but they're a great watch because there's so much energy. There's so much intelligence in the way they play, and they totally deserve the title. But it was a bit iffy, I must say, at the end. I was looking over my shoulder, so to speak, or over everybody's shoulder to see what was happening in the PSG game and what was happening as well in an extraordinary game between Lyon and Nice, which I have to say a word about.
Sure. Well, let's just quickly, before you get onto that, Harry says, how does this compare to Montpellier's victory in 2012? Like, did anyone give Lille any chance at the start of the season? And is there any hope that Lille can keep this side together and do something in next year's Champions League?
I think that it is even more remarkable than Montpellier, or actually even Lille, just a bit before that. Remember, they did the double with Rudy Garcia I would say even more remarkable because of the circumstances, because of the means at Galtier's disposal, and of the fact that the PSG team of now is a much, much stronger animal than the one that Laurent Blanc was in charge of. And so I would say, yes, it's in a way, it's an exploit. It's a greater one than what Montpellier achieved. It doesn't quite have the same feel. I mean, Montpellier, there was a kind of human adventure around it that was quite extraordinary. It's like nobody was expecting them to do that. It was a great group of players, but certainly not as good, perhaps, as a squad as Lille is this season. These were more innocent times in a way. Maybe Montpellier's success was a bit more emotional, and for obvious reasons as well, because there were crowds in the ground. But nobody was giving them a chance of winning the title at the beginning of the season. Whoever will say that was, you know, they were thinking, oh, yeah, they're going to be there or thereabouts. No. People were thinking, well, with a bit of luck, they've got a good manager, they've kept a few good players, placed in the Europa League, perhaps pushing for top four, top three, but the title, no, never.
Philippe, it seems quite extraordinary that a team of PSG's resources and talent didn't win the league by 20 points. I mean, how much of the story is that?
Well, if you look at what Lille did, despite the fact that they sometimes slipped against opponents that you wouldn't expect them to slip against, they performed extremely well against the, I would say, top five teams, first thing. Second thing, PSG started with a handicap. They started with a 6 points handicap because they just were not ready for the first two rounds of the league. They lost both games, games which normally they would have won quite easily, even the so-called Clásico against Marseille. They hadn't had a preseason. They were still recuperating from the lost Champions League final. There were problems within the club with between Tuchel and Leonardo and so forth. So PSG lost 8 games this season. That's remarkable, isn't it? And but you could say that the context played a big part in that. The fact as well that they had a number of players missing for quite a while. Neymar for a change, for example. And it is a surprise, but perhaps given the way the season started, not so much. And winning by 20 points, I don't want to say anything silly, but I don't think they've ever won by 20 points. They're not that, you know, I know that every defeat of PSG is always welcome, so to speak, excuse me, PSG fans, with a degree of surprise and almost shock, but they've been losing games over the past few years. And by the way, I just remember, Max, you were asking about the chances of Lille in the Champions League doing anything. I think they're very, very, very small. I doubt it. Galtier won't be there any longer, for starters. They're going to lose their main man.
We should mention Neymar's penalty miss yesterday.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, with the Simone Zaza kind of run-up.
And the keeper standing sort of on the right post.
Yeah. And then beautifully, in slow motion, almost side-footing the ball wide off the post. That was absolutely magnificent. And on the other hand, it must be said that Neymar is usually somebody who is a very good penalty taker. He'd actually already taken 5 this season and slotted them in the net, all 5 of them. That was a bit of an aberration. But at the time, it felt really important because you thought, who knows? Because PSG were not guaranteed a place in the Champions League at the start of the day. You know, if Monaco had done something which they didn't, OL had done something which they certainly didn't, you thought, well, there is a chance if PSG loses that game, they could find themselves out of an automatic spot in the Champions League.
And you wanted to mention the Lyon-Nice game?
It was fantastic. I mean, probably the best game of the day in Ligue 1. And again, it's very odd. Nice had absolutely nothing to fight for, but just their honor, so to speak. And they did. And OL, I think it's just almost like a perfect illustration of their season. They were on top twice, leading, and they blew it up. And the result of that is Lyon will not be in the Champions League next season, which is pretty bad, believe me.
Probably more important than any of this, you wanted to talk about UEFA awarding the 2025 women's under 19 Euros to Belarus.
Yeah, and that was a decision which was taken. And this decision was pushed back, I think, in the news agenda, if it could have been put on the news agenda, because of the Super League debacle and the fact that UEFA were considered to be the good guys and so forth. Well, in the same breath as they were denouncing the Super League, they were awarding the under 19 women's Euro Championship of 2025 to what is the rogue regime in Europe, in continental Europe. We knew that at the time. We knew that there was repression, in particular of footballers and other sports people in Belarus who are opposing the dictatorship of Lukashenko. And we've had another demonstration of the nature of this regime by this unbelievable story of the hijacking of that plane, forcing the plane, which was bound for Vilnius from Athens, I believe, and Roman Protasevich, who is a journalist and activist, human rights activist and political activist, being forcibly removed, probably with the help of four KGB agents on the tarmac of Minsk, and now facing a very long time in jail and even in absolute terms, the death penalty, because Belarus is the only country in Europe which actually applies the death penalty. And so the idea that UEFA could not, I mean, could award a tournament to this regime, I mean, it has to now reconsider its position. By the way, it's there would be a precedent for that. I think the Biathlon International Federation, there was an event which was supposed to take place in Minsk, and they've decided that in the end, no, they would remove it and they've switched the event to Finland. And I think it's UEFA would only be doing the right thing and perhaps the only thing to do, which is to take this tournament off this awful regime.
We should say that whilst as of recording, UEFA are yet to come out publicly following recent events in Belarus. They have responded to previous criticisms from FIFPro via a spokesperson who told Inside the Games that several events that were meant to be held in Belarus in 2020-21 had been cancelled. The spokesperson went on to quote, "The UEFA Executive Committee thus eventually decided to award the organisation of the Women's Under-19 European Championship to the Belarus Football Federation, but only in 2025. That is in 4 years' time." Thank you, Max, and thank you, Philippe. Germany, Lars, Robert Lewandowski scores loads of goals, doesn't he? I saw Rafa Honigstein saying, "Few people outside Germany realise how big a deal this is, beating Gerd Müller's 49-year-old record of 40 goals in a season."
Yeah, because it is very much one of those records that in modern times you feel like it's almost unfair to compare anyone to, because no one's going to beat that. It's a silly number. No one's going to score that many goals. But Robert Lewandowski had done it, and he's done it starting only 28 games this season. So he scored 41 league games in 28 starts. It's completely absurd. And anyone who wants to devalue this, you kind of hear and say, well, you know, defenses were tougher back in the day. You know what? During the first lockdown, when there was no football, I watched quite a lot of old football. And yeah, defenses would kick you more, but good Lord, they were not very well organized at all. Like, there were a lot of teams where the players were just like, well, hang on, where's he gone off to? And it was just sort of, yeah, they're much better organized now, even in the Bundesliga, where there is some weird defense now and again.
In what little I read of inverting the pyramid, you know, back in Gert Müller's day, teams regularly played two at the back.
Yes, exactly right. You're right. I think everyone who says things about football in the past could do themselves a favour and watch some of it.
He does have this reputation for being a flat track bully. I don't know if that's fair at all. And you look at Poland's group in the Euros. You know, Slovakia, Spain, as Sid has announced, they picked all the wrong players, and Sweden. You know, this is a great opportunity for him. In the group, he can be a flat track bully against those three minnows. And then could he do something? Is he good in? I mean, you know, I don't know the rest of the Poland squad off by heart. I apologize, but
I don't agree with the flat track bully thing. I mean, he scores against good opponents as well. What is true is that he plays for a team who creates a lot of chances. That is true. But he is uniquely suited to making the best of them, because he has this incredible instinct for finding space in the box where there is none. And even against, you know, most teams in the Bundesliga, when they come up against Bayern, they're like, oh God, this is going to be terrible. And they sort of sit back a little bit, to the extent that German teams really do that. And he's so good at finding the space and making himself available. He's also a better player in the sort of build-up play than he sometimes gets credit for. He isn't just a poacher. He's someone who's good. You can use him as a reference point physically. He's you know, technically more than capable to get involved and willing to get involved in build-up. He's got 7 assists as well this season. So it's 31 goals and 7 assists. The trouble with him vis-a-vis Poland is that, put too fine a point of it, Poland is quite a slow team. And they're not a team that will get the ball to him in and around the box as many times a game as Bayern Munich does. And very often they're a team whose chances come on the break, where maybe, you know, he's not Mbappe. Like, he isn't rapid. He's not someone who's going to speed away from opposing defenses. So he has slightly more difficult conditions at Poland. He's definitely a striker who does thrive on service, and he doesn't necessarily get that for Poland.
There was lots of debate about whether Borussia Dortmund would make the top four in the end. In the end, they did. I just wonder what implications that has for Erling Braut Haaland and Jadon Sancho's futures.
So, especially with Haaland, as I understand it, the plan was that they definitely wanted him to stay. I mean, there wasn't a plan for him to be sold this summer, but suddenly they were facing the prospect of Borussia Dortmund not making the Champions League, at which point the time frame for his sort of career path and trajectory might have been changed a little bit, because it means not being in the Champions League, which matters a lot to him, but it also means financially that it's going to be difficult for Dortmund to rebuild. So maybe he would be looking at a couple of lost seasons. And it was interesting, he had a period, he missed a couple of games with injury, And the camera kept panning to him in the stands, because he was the most sort of crazed Dortmund fan in the stadium in these games. I mean, you've seen with Haaland when other players score, it's almost terrifying, because you get this giant sort of sit-for-something Nordic man running over to shake you or lift you up or do these weird things he does. He's a very passionate young man. No, he was as passionate but more in the stands when Dortmund were winning without him. You know, he clearly really, really wanted them to do it, even when he wasn't on the field. And I think part of that, I mean, this is me, you know, putting two and two together and making an albatross, but I think he really wants to be there for at least one more season. It suits him. He's developed really well. He's at a place where he's, you know, everyone knows him now. They know his runs. It's a great place for him to be. And if now that they make the Champions League, I think being there for another season is completely fine for him. With Sancho, it's a little bit more complicated, because I think there's always been an assumption that they'll sell him this summer and for a slightly lower fee than what they wanted last season, which makes sense because he's a year closer to the end of his contract. But of course, you wonder if it's really if the market is really there, to use a phrase, because they still want a lot of money for him, and not a lot of clubs have a lot of money. And he has been fantastic in the second half of the season. He had a bit of a wobble in the autumn and wasn't quite himself. In the second half of the season, he's been unbelievably good, Jadon Sancho. And they have been on this winning run now towards the end of the season, winning 6 straight games, which they really had to win. And some of those were difficult games to get to the Champions League. And you just see the sort of Haaland-Sancho link up. And you just see, well, if you can just get one more season of that, even if with this new coach, we don't know quite how that's going to be. So I think they're still going to ask for a very big transfer fee. I'm not sure there's someone out there who wants to pay a big transfer fee. If there's anyone you're going to pay it on, Sancho is worthy. He's young and he's an unbelievably good player. If you'd asked me a couple of months ago, I said for sure he's selling this summer. Everyone knows this. But right now, maybe there's a chance he stays as well.
Werder Bremen got relegated after flirting with it last season and getting away with it. That's quite a big deal, is it? I was trying to put an English equivalent. It would be Everton going down, maybe?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison, except Werder Bremen have won the league in sort of semi-recent memory, so I'd say they're almost an even bigger club. And I think you have to see this in the context of Hamburg going down a couple of years ago and actually not coming back up again. They messed it up again this season. And also Schalke going down this year. So I think you see a real sort of these sort of big clubs who have been maybe not run by the smartest guys in the room in recent history, who are not able to float on the fact that they're very big clubs anymore, that the relegation comes for them in the end. And it is extraordinary complacency for Werder Bremen, who had to do a sort of relegation playoff last season, because that's how they do it in the Bundesliga. The bottom two go down, the third from bottom play a relegation playoff against a team from the zweite Bundesliga. They had to do the playoffs, and then they just kind of stuck with the coach, stuck with the sporting director, and I was like, yeah, no, it'll be much better this season. and it really wasn't. I think these clubs who are traditionally too big to go down is not a good phrase, but clubs who traditionally should be fine because they're big and they've won things in the past and they have a fan base, we're seeing now in modern football that they are not safe in competition with these smaller and much more smartly and run and smartly coached football clubs. Which brings me to Union Berlin. I'm expecting we're a bit pressed for time now because I've waffled on a bit. But Union Berlin finishing seventh, making the Europa Conference, is quite extraordinary. They've got the second smallest wage bill in the league, as far as I'm concerned. As far as I know, their coach Urs Fischer. I noticed if you Google Urs Fischer, the first sort of man who comes up is a Swiss-born contemporary visual artist, not the football coach. So he's not even the most famous Urs Fischer, which must be a blow for him. but then again, Urs Fischer, the coach, is also born in Switzerland. So maybe he leads a double life as a contemporary visual art. I don't think so. But they've been very well organized and made the most out of what they have and all that. But a great achievement for them. And also Wolfsburg making the Champions League is kind of like a low-key big deal. Oliver Glasner's done a great job there. They're not always easy on the eye. As a joke, I think I've made a joke.
I'm looking forward to it again. Here we go.
No. Well, I've said about 50 times that, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. So in the land of the Bundesliga, a team who can defend will probably do quite well. And I think this is very true with Wolfsburg this season. They've not always been great to look at, but they're one of those teams, if you watch them, you won't regularly go, what? Like, where's the fullback? Like, where have you run off to? Like, everyone knows where to stand. You know, this sort of thing, which you can't always say for these teams. But a terrible blow in the end for Eintracht Frankfurt not making the Champions League, missing out by a point. Very, very disappointing for them.
Just to pick up on that thing that actually Lars kind of concluded it quite well, the shift in modern football means that we are seeing this more and more, that having a mass fan base when the immense majority of your budget comes from a TV deal is becoming increasingly less relevant, if you can increasingly become less. And I was talking to people at Villarreal this week because, of course, of the fact that they're playing Manchester United in the Europa League final. The CEO at Villarreal put it in very simple terms, said these days good management is more important than a social base. That's a reality, and it will happen increasingly, because actually what tends to happen is the bigger clubs, they've come from a period where they've amassed debts partly through being big and not being particularly well run, and they're actually in a disadvantageous position against smaller, well run clubs that come through and are still earning the same TV rights money as them. So they might not fill their stadium, or they might not have a stadium for 40,000, but their financial, if you like, maneuverability is just as good. So I think we're going to see this more often. I think the idea of what a big club is going to change.
I feel like that's true, like up to a certain level, and certainly mismanagement can undo a lot of these gains. But it's kind of what the idea of the Super League is born from, almost, is that that's true up to a certain level. But then there are a few clubs: Manchester United, Real Madrid, Juventus aspire to be in that group, but they're sort of struggling to actually put themselves in it, which have that global level of fan base that bring them so much more revenue that they are still in a different category to everyone else.
I just wanted to quickly ask, because we talked about the Spain squad, Lars, the Germany squad, they've brought in like the Expendables, you know, they've brought in the old guard again.
Well, some of these were, I mean, I was about to say some of these are no-brainers, but then again, in football, is there ever such a thing as a no-brainer when there's, you know, egos involved and this sort of thing? But no, Thomas Müller is back, Mads Hummels is back. I think some of this is made slightly easier by the fact that Love has said that Love has announced that he's going, so he doesn't need to worry about sort of the future and anything. He just has this. There's just this tournament. There's just this cluster of games you've got to play, and you want to give them yourself
one
the
last
best possible
job
chance. Yeah. One last job,
exactly. Get the team back together. We can crack this safe.
Yeah, and if you don't have to think about everything else, all the institutional stuff and all the long-term stuff, you'd be completely off your head not to bring Thomas Müller. He's been fantastic this season. And Hummels has been a little bit more of a mixed bag this season, but they're not that strong at the back and they need leaders. So you can absolutely see the appeal in bringing him back. So these are, I think, entirely sensible decisions. And really, I understand why they wanted to put some of these older players out to pasture from the national team. They wanted to move on. When we talk a lot, we have talked a lot about this season of teams where you know, it's the old guard all over again, and you have to try to move on, and you have to expedite these sort of generational shifts. But it just, you'd be cutting off your entire face despite something. I mean, you can't not bring Thomas Miller to the squad. It would be a deranged decision.
It's cutting off your face despite your body, isn't it? It's just an extension.
I just realized I'm not sure where I'd go with that. I think I might
your head.
I might have undermined the entire saying, but I think
cutting out your trachea despite your body.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, something like that.
Some breaking news that we all expected: Hansi Flick will become the new Germany national team coach after Euro 2020. Actually, we should just to round everything off, Nicky. Just how are Italy? You know, how are Italy looking? Has their squad been announced? What's happening with them?
There's a lot of enthusiasm about Italy. The provisional squad is out, which, as you know, with all these provisional squads, is enormous. There's some sort of worries. I think Marco Verratti getting injured late in the season is certainly one of those things that people are fretful about, because the strength of this team was certainly, when you looked at it in midfield, when you've got Jorginho and Verratti and Barella, who's had a fantastic season at Inter, all coming together. That's exciting. Having said that, there are lots of other exciting midfielders in Italy at the moment. So if you lose one, at least you've got options to bring in. Maybe it's Locatelli from Sassuolo, who I've really enjoyed. There's always more young options at the moment for Mancini. And look, Italy qualified really well. Italy have never gone through a whole qualifying campaign winning every game like they did with this. I think there's this sort of cautious feeling in Italy that they might be a genuinely competitive underdog that no one's taking very seriously. There's things missing from the team. There isn't still a striker you feel great about, because Ciro Immobile and Andrea Belotti, despite scoring heaps in Serie A, don't always, or really often at all, do it for the national team. But again, there are options up front. You could go for something more like a false nine. You could put Berardi in there. You've got Chiesa. You've got Insigne. There's a lot to be positive about with Italy at the moment. I'm excited about it.
What's it's coming home in Italian?
Torna a casa.
Beautiful. Well, let's finish with an email from Leslie Taylor. Subject, it's a compliment, Barry. Do you mind me reading a compliment?
Yeah, go on.
Entitled, "Greetings from a 71-year-old American female football fan. I listen to Football Weekly podcast every day on my commute to work. I have been forewarned about the risk of having an accident. It has single-handedly saved me from being sucked into the brain-killing black hole of political podcasts." That's what we're here to do. Now, I am a committed fan. Long ago, I cheered on Blackburn and Alan Shearer. I have the kit circa 94 to prove it. This year, I've been following Leicester. I just can't get behind the big four. They remind me too much of what I despise about money-grabbing American professional sports teams, all about the merch and screw the fans. Thank God for Football Weekly and I think this is all aimed at you guys, and the strange / funny panelists who participate each week. Thank you, Leslie. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it.
I want to know what Leslie's doing working at the age of 71. She put her feet up.
Yeah, there you go. I've been told. Maybe she wants to, Barry. How terribly ageist of you.
I've got in my head, America might want health insurance, but that's a political thing and we don't want it to be the political podcast they're trying to avoid.
Exactly, everything you're trying to get at. For the next hour, the health system in the United States with me, Sid, Lars, Nicky and Barry. Thank you, Leslie, for your email. We appreciate it. Footballweekly@theguardian.com. They no longer go to Barry. Barry, you were invited to a wedding. Hang on, where is it?
Do they no longer go to Barry? What happened? That was brilliant.
What did you do, Barry? You managed to change your. They all go to Barry's spam.
Well, I've accidentally. It was an accident. Blocked them from my account, and I now don't know how to unblock them.
So. It was an accident. Yeah.
I don't know where they. So anyway,
I don't know if you've been invited to a wedding, Barry. But it just says, Phoebe and Ian's wedding, thank you for registering to our event. We look forward to seeing you there. It's on the 26th of May. So it's tomorrow. Blimey.
Oh, dear.
As you need to get a suit, quick.
It's at a castle.
Wow.
Wow.
Can we all go?
Sounds nice.
Or is this just a one-person invite? Is this a Barry plus six coming? Can we all come along?
I'm not sure. It just says...
I don't know anyone called Phoebe and Ian.
No, it's Phoebe and Ian.
Well,
Barry.
I know lots of Ian's.
Phoebe and Ian. It's
no, it is, yeah. Two people. And I think that's the idea, isn't it? We don't know them, but you've been signed up by someone to go to Phoebe and Ian's wedding tomorrow at a castle.
What Barry doesn't know is he's actually the best man. You're going to have to write a tweet quick.
Shall I add it to your Google calendar, Barry?
Yeah, it's got to be tricky, that.
Whoever Phoebe and Ian are, we wish you a wonderful day and many happy years together. And that'll do for today's pod. Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Cheers, Sid.
Pleasure.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.